Welcome to the Safety Pro Roundtable. Every week on this show, you will hear from safety professionals around the industry as we talk about challenges, innovations, and stories that will help you lead a better safety program. This is the Safety Pro Roundtable.
Welcome back to the SOSPIS Safety Podcast, and I have a really exciting guest today, Tom Carson. He is SOSPIS founder and president, and Tom is a really, I really enjoy hearing your story of, you know, the journey through your career and where you are today and all the things that you learned. So I'm really looking forward to sharing that with everybody today.
Thank you, Stacy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, okay. So I guess where should we start? What beginning place in your career had the biggest impact on you?
What beginning? I think if I look at things that had the most impact on me, it was probably just growing up at a time and in a place. It was a fairly small town in the Midwest that there was just a culture of everybody was in it together. I mean, when somebody prospered, everybody prospered. When somebody suffered, everybody suffered. When somebody needed to build a garage, everybody got together and built a garage. And it was just a kind of a culture or environment of helping each other. And I suppose that, as much as anything, formed who I am. I mean, there's a notion of anything you need to get done, there's people out there to help you do it.
Tell me about your parents, because you're an entrepreneur and you've been an entrepreneur for a while. Were they entrepreneurs, or where did that come from? It seems sometimes I feel like when people are entrepreneurs, they've seen it before.
Yeah, I think I sometimes wonder in my case if I'm a traditional entrepreneur so much as just somebody who likes to make stuff. You know, when we were kids, my brother and I would make go-karts and terrorize the other little kids in the neighborhood. Later on, building parts of houses and things was just something we knew how to do. And when it came to companies, I think it's a lot of fun to look at problems and try to come up with ways to solve them. And that's been the pattern for my development, I suppose.
Did your parents encourage that kind of building and trying new things and breaking things and putting it back together?
Well, they didn't care much for the breaking things part. But understand that, you know, when I grew up, I mean, parents were a lot less involved with kids' activities than they are today. We were basically sent out of the house in the morning and told to be back by the time the streetlights came on in the summers, as a for instance. And so kids were largely found ways to entertain themselves. You know, we created our, you know, little teams for baseball or football or activities around the neighborhood.
So when you were a parent, how did that transfer? Because you've told stories about your daughters doing like Lego camps or erector set camps or things like that. Was that something that, I don't know, how did that go together, I suppose? Or do you think that they had a correlation?
I think times change, and it was pretty obvious it wasn't going to work. I grew up in a small town where people left the keys in the cars, you know, and doors unlocked. We weren't going to do that in downtown Denver when my daughters were growing up. So yeah, times change. You find ways to keep everybody active. But as the father of three daughters, I was always worked pretty hard to make sure they had activities and things to do, and busy hands are happy hands, as my grandmother used to say.
That makes sense. Okay, so what was your first job out of college?
So I was trained as basically operations and finance. I had a degree in accounting from the University of Illinois. My first job out of school was with Arthur Young, which was one of the large accounting firms in Denver. So that was, I spent several years there. They were great times, and I suppose that was the formative part of my professional life. I was lucky enough to have two mentors at Arthur Young that really shaped the interests that I had in business, and also shaped a lot of the, I suppose, a lot of the my understanding of how to communicate with people at different levels and companies. Because as an auditor or a consultant in that world, you had to be effective in working with all levels of the company, from the, the C-suite down to the people on the shop floor.
What parts of that job did you like and what didn't you like? Because I feel like we all have this notion of what a certain profession is going to be. So looking back, or what did you like and what did you say, I don't, this doesn't really fit me.
Well, I love the exposure to lots of different kinds of companies, because in that role we had many. I worked with manufacturing companies. I worked with a university. I worked with services companies. We had a there were some retail folks in there, and there were some technology companies, and that was sort of the early days of that in this area. So that I loved. I wasn't so keen on the minutiae of auditing. I thought it was interesting, but it wasn't what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
And then where did you go from there?
Well, I was lucky, like many people in that situation, I was hired by one of our customers. But I then went through a series of companies as a in a finance role. I went through a series of companies that started sometimes from sort of humble beginnings to achieve market significance. I mean, and in every case, they were companies that grew by applying technology to processes, and in some cases, we were industry leading in the technology that was adopted. So, as an example, one of my first job after Arthur Young was with a large pharmaceutical wholesaler that wasn't doing very well when the owners bought it, but they pioneered the use of electronic order entry devices and ended up speeding the process of taking orders to so that instead of having to call up to a lady on a computer who was going to input the order, we actually sent these devices. They looked like big military walkie-talkies out to the stores and the hospitals, and they were able to do the order entry themselves. And if they did that, it was direct into the computer, and they were assured they'd get their order the next day. And that was a big change for that time, and it made that it helped. It helped that company became much more order, user friendly. We were responsive. People got products faster, and it was much cheaper. So that was an example. And over the years, we had a couple of those as technology was evolving. And during the 90s and early 2000, technology was evolving quickly. There were lots of tools that became available that were new.
So, was that applied then? Because you said technology kind of was a theme throughout your profession. What was kind of the next step and the next job that technology was applied?
Well, so one of the things that was happening was the internet was emerging and evolving very quickly. The first company I was with after Arthur Young actually had email, and this was in the mid 1980s. And it was the most amazing thing in the world to be able to sit down to a computer terminal and actually send a note to somebody else in the company. But that was new. By the time we got into the 90s, the internet was becoming kind of ubiquitous. We had to go through the phase where we went through dogfood.com and all kinds of kind of odd companies. But it was clear that the changes that was bringing and the access to information were here to stay. And it was transformative for some of those companies.
So then you were in that space, and then where did that lead you next?
So one of the things that ended up happening, and eventually I landed as the chief financial officer for a relatively small computer specialty computer products distribution company that was formed by putting together three whittled companies that were all selling the same products to the same kinds of customers. And that company grew from $40 million the year it was put together to $1.6 billion in 7 years. So a huge success by any measure. And it was fueled largely by technology, fast technology changes in things like printers, in monitors, in the use of plug and play products, and Unix, which was the backbone of the internet. So this was through the growth of the internet boom. That company was eventually sold to GE, and everybody kind of scattered after that. I just decided I didn't want to be a finance person anymore. I wanted to do something more with software. And specifically, I was very interested in healthcare IT because I watched a lot of the struggles, and this was before the government mandated meaningful use, but it was clear that we were all interested in the potential power of bringing electronic medical records, and making those so that we had access, all as patients, we wanted to have access to our records. For as doctors, it would be convenient if you didn't have to do everything on paper. And there were lots of reasons why that was a good idea. And so that was actually a kitchen table startup in 2000 and grew eventually to, we had 8 or 9,000 doctors on the system. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, we started out trying to do something that doctors didn't really want to do, which was use speech recognition to create their own records. And so in those days, most doctors were actually recording little tapes, and then somebody would come to the office and pick the tapes up, and they'd go home and they'd transcribe them and bring them back in a couple of days. And that just seemed like it was ripe for technological improvement. So one thing led to another, and we ended up creating a platform that allowed us to take the audio files from the doctors, distribute the work to the transcriptionists, and then within sometimes hours, the doctors would basically have their record online. So this was an application of technology to simplify a process. And that whole experience was interesting at several levels. The first one was that if you really want people to adopt technology, you have to make it as simple as possible. And one of the problems that we encountered early was we were asking the doctors to change their habits, and they didn't want to change. They wanted to do things the way they always had. I get that. And by making a small change in the way we created the process, the doctor didn't have to change anything. And yet now everybody got their record. It was electronic, it could be distributed. And then we realized very quickly that once you had the document in electronic form, you can do all kinds of things at that point. You could actually create a usable electronic medical record system just using the doctor's words. Well, that's when everything kind of turned around and it worked really well.
So you were a part of a company that had exponential growth in a fairly short period of time and then moved on to another company. So what were some of the things that you, what were some of the wins and maybe, I hate to say losses, but not so much losses, but things that were, we'll just
We
say it
call
for
those experiences.
experiences. What were some of the wins and experiences that you were a part of or watched? In that growing company that you then took to the medical record company.
I think Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know if I'd characterize it as wins and losses. I mean, it's clearly a win to be with a company that goes from $40 million to $1.6 billion. And that's a huge, huge growth. And that's a great experience. It can be stressful, but it's rewarding. It's fun to be on something that's growing and that works, clearly. But I think an observation I had during that time was, wow, stuff can happen in a hurry. And I think even now we underestimate sometimes the speed with which technology can change, or circumstances can change, you know, your situation. 2 years ago, you know, nobody had heard of COVID-19. And yet look at what happened over the next period of time. So I think there's a recognition that there's a fragility to life and process. And it's good to be able to accept that, be aware of it, accept it when it comes and react to it. I mean, there were lots of ways that we could have reacted to the growth that Access Graphics had. And one way would have been to not ever realize it was happening and never take advantage of it. So the best thing we did was we didn't mess it up when we had the opportunity.
So that's really good. So it sounds like you posture yourself in a certain way today because of that. How do you proceed, or how do you think that you posture yourself in SOSBIS because of that? I think I know the answer, but I'll let you say.
Well, I think that gets a little bit to why we started SOSBIS, if I can kind of
talk
about that. So it was probably 9 years ago. I was introduced to the environmental health and safety space, and it was through another job that I had. I was introduced to a number of large companies that I was surprised to find that they were using paper-based forms and Excel spreadsheets to manage what seemed to me kind of complex, or at least high volume transactions to take care of what many companies call their most important asset, their employees. And it was easy to see that there was technology readily available that could simplify that pretty dramatically. So that was the first thing I noticed. The second thing I noticed that I was struck by is the systems that were generally available to companies were at that time were kind of large companies that had very comprehensive systems. I mean, they could do a lot of things, but they were complicated and they were expensive. And for many buyers, that made the return on investment a little bit hard to support. Well, going back to my previous years as a finance executive, I've been a buyer of enterprise systems. And I found those experiences to be universally frustrating. It was hard to make a vendor selection. When you made a vendor selection, it seemed like the process went on forever. The systems were expensive, and by the time they were literally in one occasion, by the time the system was implemented several years after the project started, I honestly couldn't remember what all the original requirements were, but the market had changed. And so now we're sitting here in this situation going, well, what do I have to do to adjust to the market changes? Well, we'll have to get developers on that job and we'll have to create a spec. And I just went, wow. And I believed at the time, and I continue to believe that there's no reason to do that. There's a much more effective and responsive way to build and deliver software. But it requires a little different thought process on the part of the customers. Turns out the customers are fine with that because it's so much cheaper. And the time to value, the time from when you start a relationship with a software company to the time you're actually up and using it and driving value can be very short. And so that was what the opportunity I saw with SOSPIS and the things I learned coming into SOSPIS. It had a lot to do with making sure that you were delivering a product that was easy to use, that was, you know, that could be easily deployed to everybody, but most importantly showed people how they could improve their own processes and results in fairly short order. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned that the doctors, they didn't want to use a complicated system. So that, and you probably had some growth around that, right? So it's like you took that into SOSPIS saying we have to make this really easier. People are not going to use it. And I hear you talk about that all the time, you know, and we, if it's not easy to use, people are just not going to use it. And it's true. You know, people get paralyzed by something that seems really impossible to use. And so
it seems a little trite almost, but there's a lot of truth in the notion that people let a search for the perfect get in the way of an implementation of something that can be very effective. And you don't really, this was the problem. In fact, it remains the problem today for complex healthcare information systems. You can't fault what they're hoping to get out of those systems, but the practical reality is if you can get 90% of what you want to start with, then get on with it, because that 90% is high value and you don't need that last 10%. You'll get that last 10% later. And by the time you get there, by the way, the world may have changed. And so let's, it may be a different 10% you're trying to get at that point.
So if you were, I guess I'll ask you a two-part question. The first, I'll just set it up and then we can answer it in two separate ways. But if you are a safety pro, what lens would you use, or what things would be important to you in terms of a safety software system? Like what would you be looking for? And then in the lens of a C-suite, what would be important to you? So we'll start with the safety pro. If you are a safety pro, what does that look like for you?
So that's a great question. And I think it depends a lot on where the company is and the maturity of their processes and their systems. So there's a really famous model that was developed largely by DuPont, I think, during the 90s, called the Bradley curve, DuPont-Bradley curve. But there's lots of variations of this. The concept is that at the very basic level, you may have a company that all they're doing is struggling to ensure OSHA compliance. They're kind of hoping that all the workers have the initiative and common sense knowledge to not do things that are horribly dangerous or hazardous. And so it's a very reactive situation, and the philosophy at that point is we're hoping for the best. So that's one extreme, and you can progress through increasing levels of maturity that require things like a visible management commitment to the program. In the reactive stage, basically the entire company has delegated responsibility for safety to the safety pro. And they're running around usually without very good systems, trying to, you know, they're acting as the safety police because that's all they can really do. But as you mature the program, then the safety pro, then it becomes increasingly a shared responsibility. And so by the time you move out of the reactive stage, now maybe you've got all of your supervisors and maybe senior managers who are proactively trying to manage these processes, and they're doing a lot more training. So there's more engagement. And then by the time you get to the end of a truly participatory or collaborative safety program, everybody is kind of watching out for each other. There's a high level of awareness of what it takes, you know, what it takes to recognize hazards and mitigate those. So it's very participatory. So the answer to your question is what the safety pro wants is going to depend a lot on where they are on that continuum. if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the lens of a C-suite, if you were the VP of, you know, a manufacturing facility, what lens are you looking through in terms of why you would choose a safety software? What's going to be appealing to you? What are you looking for?
So again, I think it's going to depend a little bit on the maturity of the organization. But in general, if I'm any member of the C-suite, I'm probably going to use the lens of, well, what's the return on investment? If I write a check today, what do I get for that? And so where a very immature program, a very reactive program, may struggle a little bit with that is if there's not a keen understanding of the value of low incident rates and proactive continuous improvement, then they're going to struggle to support the return on investment. I think we've kind of moved past that. For most good companies are perfectly aware that there's an enormous value in ensuring that there's a safe and engaged workforce. And so now it becomes an issue of, all right, so what else can you do for me, Ms. Safety Professional, if we get this system? And the fact is that the whole area of responsibility for safety, the whole safety profession, has also matured over time. And you can see that there was a recent salary survey that showed that of safety professional compensation. I think the median compensation was in the mid $90,000 range, and degreed safety professionals in larger companies, it was running as high as $125,000. Well, you don't pay that kind of money for safety police. You pay that kind of money for people right. who can actually anticipate and manage risk mitigation and participate in helping the organization meet high-level organizational goals. And safety plays a huge part of that.
So we've talked a lot about kind of where safety is today. So where do you see safety software, how it will change over the next several years? What does that look like to you?
So that's a great question. I think the way to think about that, though, is software generally is a tool for leverage. It's like any other tool. So when accounting systems came out, it made it so accountants with green eyeshades didn't have to sit around and manually post journal entries and write checks and all that kind of stuff. When you know, computer-aided design software came out and became powerful, it dramatically shortened the time that it took an engineer to prepare the working designs and, more recently, the inputs into the computerized machines that make those products. Safety software is no different. I mean, it's a tool that leverages the knowledge and the skills of safety professionals, and safety professionals they have enormous experience in this thing. But if they're running around, if they're forced to take on lots of administrative overhead tasks, you don't get the benefit of that knowledge. And so by automating administrative tasks, by spreading out participation in the safety process to more of the people in the company in a structure that the safety professional can manage, you get this compounding leverage from their knowledge and skills that's tough to beat. Now, and by that, I mean, now you've got lots of people in a company looking for identifying hazards and making suggestions on how to mitigate those. And there's a process for tracking it. And I don't have to try to find the paper form to submit the near miss report and hope it gets to where it's supposed to go and so forth. Where that goes in the future, I think, is going to depend a lot on the individual organizations, I suppose. But in general, you can assume that there will be that the safety platform could operate as a platform for adoption of other technologies. So for instance, the Internet of Things. So maybe now we're going to automate tracking of hazardous materials, exposure, you know, potential exposures. So you start to get some overlap with the industrial hygiene area. I think there's a huge move right on going on right now, driven by climate and sustainability issues around what they call ESG software or process. And that's almost certainly going to have to be supported by software. And there's a clear logical path where a lot of that software could end up on the same platform that you use to manage your safety program. I think that safety will increasingly be recognized as a major component of organizational risk management. I mean, it already manages a big piece of what companies have to deal with at a worker level, but there's no reason why that same way of thinking can extend from, for instance, continuous improvement of safety processes to continuous improvement of all processes. It's exactly the same situation.
Yeah, that was actually my next question. We've seen in SOSFIS a trend. Hello, puppy.
Hello.
We've seen a trend in people, our safety professionals, bringing in all of the other organizations or all the other departments into the conversation of safety software. And that's really, we know the benefit of that, but I guess just what is the benefit of bringing all of the people to the table in this conversation of choosing a safety software and what that does for organizational processes?
So I think it's at least a two-part advantage. First of all, as safety programs and process, as safety programs mature, one of the ways they mature is they become more inclusive of the workers and the departments in a company. So again, it moves from at a totally reactive end of the spectrum of having the safety professional delegating everything to the safety professional, to the other end, everybody in the organization is deeply involved in ensuring that processes are operated safely. That's one step, is everybody has a stake in this, and everybody needs to be participating in it to get to true safety excellence. I think the other thing that happens though is that the platform for a good safety program is actually extensible to other things that go on in the company. And the same tools can be multi-purposed, if you will. So for instance, we have customers that use SOSFIS as a safety platform, but they also use functions of it for quality processes, to document quality and manage some things that go in and out there. Logically, anytime that you're involved with managing worker safety, there's often an HR component to this. Well, the same platform that is used for reporting incidents or observations or close calls in the field can also be used to deliver things like current credentials. It can be used to deliver training. It can be used. And if you're delivering training and managing certification levels, then that overlaps into the HR world, because that may affect people's pay grades. It may affect what they're allowed to be doing in the first place. Now, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we've been seeing that a lot, and we talk about that a lot. And we have customers of ours that have, maybe at the beginning didn't involve those people, but as they've grown and used the software, they've included other departments and parts of the organization, and now they're rolling and they're seeing benefits in the overall organizational processes, not in just safety and incidents and close calls. I mean, it is such a bigger picture than that.
Well, I think that's right. At the end of the day, you've got to, one of the many struggles that I think the safety profession has had to overcome is kind of a siloed approach to their role in the world. And again, that's without trying to beat this to death, a reactive system is almost by nature a little bit too siloed. And as organizations mature, as the processes mature, there's this spreading out and elimination of silos. Because at the end of the day, if everybody's working together, it is a lot more effective. But I think there's also a practical aspect to this too. I mean, a company doesn't want to be running 20 systems. They just don't. I mean, it's expensive. It reinforces or continues the whole siloed approach. And by tearing down those silos, by dropping the borders to collaboration, everyone gets both smarter and more efficient. And I just think that's something that we're seeing is now that there are good options for software for running those kinds of processes.
So you're not just a software guy. You are a leader, and I mean, you're the leader of an organization with lots of different personalities and lots of different people, and we have an awesome team. So what do you think is your favorite part about being an owner of a company that has people and I'll let you answer that, but yeah, how does that feel? How do you feel responsible, or does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I'm not answering. It's not coming out right.
So I think the big, it comes back to, I just like to make stuff. I've always enjoyed making stuff. I've always enjoyed making stuff better. It's enormously frustrating when you don't see progress moving, but when you do, when you see other people starting to improve their worlds and people come back and say, wow, that made all the difference in the world. I couldn't be happier that I met you guys. I mean, that, you know, as long as when you get that kind of feedback, it reinforces everything that you're doing. I love the fact with Sospice, I love the fact that we've done a pretty good job of finding people to, you know, as team members who all feel the same way. I mean, it's when you get everybody, when everybody's kind of aligned in what you're trying to accomplish, and I think our value set and our mission are pretty clear, then you get those kinds of results. And I've been doing this long enough that I recognize pretty quickly when it's working and when it's not. So maybe that's the most important thing I took out of Arthur Young many years ago, the beginning of that journey.
Your core values. I was really impressed when I met you and started being introduced to Sospice, your core values. Can you walk through why those are important to you? Because they're really beautiful and they're impressive as well.
Well, sure. I mean, I think everybody needs a kind of a North Star when you get right down to it. And our core values are, they're not terribly complicated, and they really at the end of the day all boil down to treating each other with the same way that we want to be treated. I mean, it's the notion of having respect for each other and respect for our customers. It's the notion of always being honest in our transactions and our interactions. It's the notion of a little bit of humility goes a long ways. Nobody has all the answers. You just don't. And if you approach each day with a little bit of gratitude about what you have and where we are, first of all, it makes us a little more receptive to understanding somebody else's point of view. And you have to do that. I mean, when you make software, it's not, you can't just, this is the one of the lessons from the early days of my healthcare documentation company. I mean, you can't just declare, I know this is the right answer. And if the doctors don't think it's the right answer, they're not going to use it and your company won't succeed. So, you know, humility is an important part of that. And continuous improvement is just something we all should be interested in, whether it's us individually, whether it's our company, whether it's, you know, the relationship we have with our significant others. I mean, these are important things and we should never take them for granted. And I just saw a quote by Terry Mathis, who's the now retired founder of a company called Proact. He's a very well-known safety consultant. And he made the point that we shouldn't necessarily be always looking for best practices. We should be looking for better practices. And I that so struck me. I need to send him an email and thank him for that, because I'm going to use it unabashedly here going forward. But it's an interesting notion if you think about it, because implied in that is you don't really know what the best practices are. Right? I mean, right? So you should always be looking for better practices. I love that. And we'll use it and call it mine from now on.
I don't see why not. I think it's a great idea. I think this has been really nice. You know, every time you tell the story of your journey, I think it's really interesting how someone progresses to where they are now. And I appreciate you sharing kind of what you've learned and kind of what got you here, because that's important. You take all those experiences and then you bring them to where we are now. So I don't know. I'm really grateful that you took the time to share it with me and with everybody, because it matters. It's important. For me, you know, I always think it's important to know, who someone is and why they do what they do and kind of what is their why. And so, you were able to tell me about that today. So I really appreciate it.
Stacy, it's absolutely my pleasure. I always enjoy
chatting. Thank you. So I ask everyone this question before we go, and I may have already asked you this, so I'm not sorry, but do you think that a hot dog is a sandwich?
A hot dog is a hot dog.
But you have two pieces of bread.
Oh, I know.
And meat inside. And meat inside.
It's a hot dog. It's a hot dog. Sandwiches have flatbread.
Okay, but really quickly, I've ordered a sub sandwich before. No.
It can, you know what? I think you should call it anything you want.
I think that a sandwich is always superior to a hot dog, so it should not be put in the same category. But I always like asking these people questions. And here's why. I think that it's really interesting to watch someone process it and tell me their answer, because I think it says a lot about somebody. Either you're going to blurt it out because you're convicted, or you think about it and then you tell the answer, or some people just go on and on about, and they're not really sure and they never really decide on something. So I think it's like, it tells a lot about someone. No, you're not buying it?
I'm not buying it. No. It's what you want it to be.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And I'm grateful to work here and be a part of this team. So yeah, thank you very much.
And we're happy to have you.
Thank you for joining us on the Safety Pro Roundtable. This podcast is brought to you by Sospis, bringing you the best EH software in the industry. If you're ready to learn more about how an EHS software can transform your safety program, your profits, and your entire company, head to www.sospes.com/podcast. That is www.sospes.com/podcast. We'll see you next time on the Safety Pro Roundtable.